have an antenna, say Yagi, you would have the same effect. Isn't that true, Etuexia?
Yes, it is. What's really going on here is that, assume now that I've set up an antenna range in order to test this 2-meter antenna. I have followed the WA5VJB website, WA5VJB.com. I've gone there, and I've gone to one of the pages of his website that's a little bit hard to find, but he's got a page dedicated toward cheap Yagis. And one of his Yagis, he literally tells you how to take coat hanger wire and a wooden slot used as the boom, and you cut these pieces of coat hanger wire in just the right shape, you make a driven element, and just the right length, and you make directors and reflectors. So I built that Yagi antenna. And now I want to measure the performance of that Yagi antenna. So I built an antenna range in my backyard. I set that antenna up as a receiving site, and I set up a downrange, another antenna just like it, to transmit a signal to me. And I'm going to measure signal strengths in order to calculate gain. Let me drop. By knowing the strength of the signal coming out of my transmitter, by knowing the distance between the two antennas, and by measuring the signal strength that I receive, I can calculate gain. And I could start swishing the antenna in azimuth and elevation and measure antenna pattern. And you think you're measuring the performance of that antenna. Not really. You're measuring the performance of that antenna in that environment. In the case of measuring an amplifier on the table, I can measure its gain, its signal-to-noise ratio, its standing wave ratio, input and output. It's a closed package device that I can really measure in my laboratory on the table. I can measure an amplifier. You think you're going to measure an antenna. You're measuring the antenna plus all of the environment around it. I've got ground reflection on that antenna range. I got reflection off the guard of the gutters and the downspout of the house. I got reflection off of the wiring and the plumbing of the house. I got reflection off some of the trees that are in that backyard. I'm measuring the performance of that antenna in that environment. Some of those measurements I'm making are being contaminated by that environment. Unless I put that antenna, let me drop. Unless I put that antenna into the world's most perfect anechoic chamber, then and only then can I really measure the performance of the antenna all by itself. Under normal circumstances, absolutely not. That antenna is being contaminated by the environment. And so, you guys are going to be hearing some music as soon as I drop the signal. Somebody is putting a music signal on the input right now. But I think I'll hear you over him. So, as you see, Wes, an antenna is a unique device. It is a electromagnetic transducer buried into an environment of your and my backyard, which is going to modify the measurements. Those two scratchy screwdrivers are part of that environment. N2XJN, K2LIW.
It's in the Hicksville area. Any station in the Hicksville area has a reports in the or RFI at limark.org, please.
I didn't say probably. I said John Picard and give another question to Dick.
You got it, sir. John, is does it make a difference whether the antenna is passive or active? And I think the answer is almost no. In other words, because the good news about transmitting a radio signal, as you've heard me say so often, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. That's the good news. It goes everywhere. And even if you think you've got a perfectly shielded room that cuts down the signal strength by 100 dB, but it doesn't kill the signal, it just makes it weaker. Another way of looking at that is there's multipath everywhere. I'm transmitting a signal to you right now, we'll say, and that signal, the direct path between Huntington, where I am, and Toad Hill in Staten Island, where you are, you'd like to believe that's a direct path. There's at least 1 million other paths happening simultaneously between me and you. And your receiving antenna, let me drop. Your receiving antenna takes every one of those million individual signals. You could say it calculates, but it doesn't really calculate. It adds together those individual signals, recognizing their amplitudes and their phases. So each one of those is a vector. It's got an amplitude, and it's got a phase angle. And if your antenna adds all those together, when you think you're doing an antenna test between your transmitting antenna and the antenna under test on your antenna range, you think there's only one path. There's almost a million paths there. You think you're measuring the antenna. You're measuring the antenna plus the environment where you've put the antenna and your antenna range. Other than putting that antenna into the world's most perfect anechoic chamber, that's the only time when you're really measuring the antenna all by itself. Every other realistic antenna range, you're measuring the antenna plus environment. And unless you're smart enough to calculate how much contamination the environment is in order to grind that back out of the answer, there are times when, let me drop. If you don't recognize what the environment is doing to the antenna that you think you're testing, you can come up with some crazy numbers, a very high gain, very low gain, and whatever. The most ridiculous example along these lines that I can think of is that there's a company that shall remain nameless in Taipei, Taiwan, that's manufacturing antennas for a client that I had, manufacturing zillions of these antennas at 915 megacycles, manufacturing them with great accuracy, doing a beautiful job, manufacturing them at a 1/4 or 1/8 the price of the exact same product made in the United States. This is a injection molded antenna, VHF antenna, UHF antenna, that had to have very low standing wave ratio. And this company was testing every antenna they built. They weren't sample testing, they were testing every single one. And the standing wave ratio test, 98% of them were beautiful and they passed, and 2 or 3% of them fell out of spec, and they threw them away, ate them, did whatever. We never got any bad ones. However, they decided that they should measure the gain and the standing wave ratio, because everybody that builds an antenna measures the gain. They didn't understand the way the antenna works. They didn't understand that it was Endfire Yagi-like antenna. They assumed that it was a broadside antenna, a phased array. It was such an unusual shape, they didn't recognize it. They did a beautiful job of building it. But when they were testing it, the two antennas were not aimed at each other. The two antennas were aimed at the ceiling. And the signal that they got between transmitter and reception was a signal that bounced off the metal ceiling of the building. Therefore, the gain number they came up with was about 12 dB low. And you think I was alarmed by that? Absolutely not. They were building the antenna to the repeater. Time out. They were building the shape to the antenna that we desired, to the nearest 1,000th or 10,000th of an inch. Beautiful accuracy on both the metallic object, the way the coax connector was soldered in, the way the injection molding was done with no voids and whatever. mechanically they were producing these antennas like bricks, if you know what I mean. Every one was identical. And as long as the standing wave ratio was low enough, there is no way in hell the gain couldn't be there. The fact that they didn't measure the gain didn't bother me in the slightest. I knew that if they could carefully measure the gain, one antenna would have a gain of 6.1 dB, one have a gain of 6.102 dB. Anything greater than 5.5 dB would work like a charm. And I knew that the real variation, because the standing wave ratio was built to such a tight spec, the gain had to be there. It had no choice. The antenna had the right shape. It had the right wherewithal to give us an extremely low standing wave ratio, 1.01 to 1 or better. Therefore, the gain had to be there. There was no choice. Let me give you a crazy example to make this point a little more clear. Let me drop. I'm building a building, and I'm making the building out of bricks. And I want each of the bricks to be roughly the same size, roughly the same strength. So I measure these bricks by weighing them, and every so often I take a couple of them and put them into a crushing machine to make sure they get the right crush strength. And somebody says, how do you know that each brick is being affected by gravity the same way? Aren't you going to drop each one of the bricks and measure how long it takes to fall 5 feet? If the brick has the right mass and the right strength and the right shape, do you have to measure whether or not gravity is going to pull on that brick correctly? Absolutely not. By the same token on this antenna, if the antenna had the right shape and the gain is coming from the shape, and if it's got the right shape plus the right connection so that the standing wave ratio is low, it has no choice and to every one of them have the exact same gain. And the fact that they couldn't measure the gain didn't bother me at all. We just ignored that piece of the data. So there's the worst case in the world. They were aiming the antennas not at each other. The two antennas were being aimed at the roof that 10 feet above them and getting a reflected signal recorded as a chart on the vector network analyzer. I just ignored those particular charts. They wanted to do it that way. It's okay with me. The price was right. They felt uncomfortable about not measuring gain. I made a couple of attempts to teach them how to aim the antennas at each other. Because of the language barrier between Chinese and the United States, they never caught on to that. So I just ignored that. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Of course, it's scary. Okay, what I was saying before is I look at all antennas, except maybe something exotic, built-in stuff. Even so, they're all passive to me. And with reciprocity and the way they work, I don't see that they're active elements at all. They're just strictly passive. That's all I was trying to say. KC2WGB, that's it from the mailbag, so I think we should go on to Paul before we put him to sleep. So back to you, Dick.
One more question?
Yeah, Wes recognized. There's a whole class of antennas where, say for instance, I'm building a phased array of 16 individual elements, and I want to be able to electronically steer that antenna. So I put 16 individual solid-state transmitters at each one of those antennas. And by some kind of an additional signal I send to those transmitters, I can vary the phase and or amplitude of those 16 transmitters. I'm doing it right at the antenna element itself. It's a very active, adaptable antenna. And that kind of an antenna does exist. And now I'm testing this active antenna on your antenna range. The fact that I've used an active antenna instead of a passive antenna, but I'm using it in the transmit mode, all my testing is almost the same. From the point of view of the receiving device on that antenna range that picks up the signal transmitted by this active antenna, that active antenna is a black box. And whether the signal coming out of there is passive or active doesn't matter. I will admit that if I now want to use that active antenna in the receive mode instead of the transmit mode, life's going to get more complicated. But it's a hard thing to accept that when you test an antenna, you think you're testing the antenna. You're really testing the antenna plus environment. In 2XJN, K2RIW, Red West.
Yeah, that's something that is exotic that was never, I didn't hear it was discussed. I mean, I was thinking whether to start Butterworth filter or kind of exotic, found something. Brahman Magic Transformer, Bramham. And Bramham. And a good thing about it, it is made out of the transmission line. I wonder if you could say something about it. It is very, very interesting. Attention.
Okay, I've often said there are 5,000 kinds of antennas. And of those 5,000 antennas, about 500 of them have somebody's proper name associated with the antenna. Wallen Weber, Yagi, and so on. There's lots and lots of antennas that have a name associated with them. Brahman is a new one on me. Wes, go ahead.
Yeah. Now, this thing is not new. 1961. It's not very much known to the amateurs, but it's known to the professionals. Let's say you have a quarter wave transformer which has two impedances, Z1 or Z2. And they are matched by using quarter wave transmission line of characteristic impedance of squared root of Z1 and Z2. It works very well, but it requires the non-standard characteristic impedance. So let's say we have a 50 ohm load to 75 ohm cable, and a quarter wave transformer that needs a length of the cable characteristic impedance, and that will come somewhere about 62, maybe 61, and a change ohm. So with the 12 wave transformer that is being called the 12 wave transformer, the two lengths of the cable are used in series, and each is electrically near the 12 wavelength. But the characteristic of impedance is equal to two impedances, which would be the Z1 and the Z2. So those things will be matched. Now, you look at that, you would see something like a pieces of the transmission line, could be a coaxial cable, in the distance to each other, but they will have a different length. And then you would actually derive the length of it by...
Lots of hams have built phased array antennas where the phasing harness that feeds the individual Yagis, so to speak, have various techniques for power dividing, impedance matching, and so on. So far, I haven't heard any magic. All I've heard is the complication of the phasing harness that feeds the individual elements of the antenna. Back to you, Wes.
It is rather not for the antenna, but rather for the matching circuitry. Yeah, you could make the antenna out of it if you want to, but it's rather that you could calculate using a simple coaxial cable pieces. So it would be the length of the piece of the coaxial cable, the distance between, and the length of another piece, and they are very, very much in the length. And that's how you make the matching to say the impedance. Now, what puzzled me in it is that it's being called 12 wave transformer. And based on what I see, the characteristic is very broad, compatible to the quarter wave transformer, but the SWR would be, of course, the function of the frequency where the 12 wave transformer we use to match the impedance ratios between Z1 and Z2, and if we go with the SWR, that would say 1.5 to 2 to 3 and 4. So the frequency axis extends from the DC to 50% higher than nominal design frequency. all the way up and say the transformer is tuned to 50 megahertz, and we still would be able to have a match. In other words, to understand it, let's say we have a 50 megahertz. Standing by. 50 megahertz, then we have a 50 ohm coaxial cable, then we have a 75 ohm tuned piece of the coaxial cable, then we have a 50 ohm, and then we have a 75 ohm. So it would be kind of magic impedance thing. Does it ring the bell? And to experience.
Yes, there were a couple of articles that appeared in the RADCOM, Radio Society of Great Britain magazine, by which you can synthesize the geometric mean impedance of a quarter wave matching transformer by using the coax cable you've already got. In the case of 50 ohms matching to 75, where you need a 61 and a fraction ohm quarter wave length, you can
I can't. How about 145 group trip to Mali for radio expedition?
If somebody's transmitting on 146.25 and he doesn't know it, and it sounds like Steve, what I'm saying is that by using a 12th wavelength approximately of the wrong impedance, in other words, I start up with 50, I put in a 12th wavelength of 75, then a length of 50, and then I jump back to the 75, that's the final output impedance. If you adjust those individual lengths in between, you can synthesize the piece of 60 ohm cable by using just the right length of 50 and 75. And that's, I think it's called the 12th wavelength impedance matching technique. And I first became aware of this out of a technical article out of Radio Society of Great Britain. So when you call it 12 wavelength, I think you meant 1/12 wavelength. Is that true, Wes, in 2XJN, K2RIW?
That is correct. It is my English. 12th wavelength. Interesting.
So a person who doesn't want to homebrew the 61 ohm piece of cable, and if he reads the right article, there is a way of taking pieces of 50 and 75 of just the right length and synthesizing the piece of 61 that you need, and you get a very good impedance match. And I believe the technique is a little bit more broadband. It's approaching the so-called Minerva line. The other way of doing impedance matching is a very slow taper. If I started off with a 50 ohm transmission line and I slowly taper the center conductor diameter or the outer conductor diameter such that at the far end I now have 75 ohm cable, and if I make the taper slow enough, there will be no reflection, and the technique is extremely broadband. And Mr. Minerva wrote that article way back in the 40s. And that's the exotic way of doing impedance matching. Very broadband, very exact, very low loss. But to synthesize something that slowly changes in impedance, to physically make that, could be a little bit difficult. John, I think we've run out of questions that you want to ask tonight. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
That's correct, Dick. Mailbag's finished. I go over to Paul. KC2WGB, clear.
After Paul, if you could answer the question, what happens if you have a 5 or 6 Butterworth bandpass filters connected together?
Okay, I see if Paul's ready. WS2N, what's the latest in space? Over to you, Paul. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody. It's WS2N. There's not a lot of things happening this week. We're supposed to have the SpaceX Falcon 9 takeoff tomorrow, and that was supposed to be on Monday, and then it was delayed to Friday, and now it's delayed again to January 6th. So we'll see what happens with that, and that's the one that's going to be launched from Florida to the International Space Station for a cargo flight, which they've done quite a few times already. I believe this is the CRS-5. This is the flight they're going to bring the Falcon 9 back to a landing platform the size of a football field. It's about 300 feet by 170 feet. I know we talked about this the last couple of weeks, but if anybody's listening now that wasn't listening then, that's what they plan on doing. First stage will send the rest of the spacecraft into orbit, and first stage will be flying probably about 50 miles high at about 3,600 miles per hour, about a mile per second. And then the three of the nine rocket engines will ignite. And then essentially slowing it down and eventually trying to work its way back toward Florida, toward the Florida coast, where the landing platform will be. And then the 14-story first stage has these fins that will open up, four fins near the top of the stage to aerodynamically try to control the landing to the platform. And when it gets near the platform, landing legs open up. Each landing leg is 30 feet long, so there's four of them that I consider a little over 60 foot width for landing legs. Of course, you can't open up landing legs early on, because aerodynamically that would destroy destroy the flight coming down. So right at the very end, the landing legs hydraulically open up. And there's a couple of other things that are happening now in Florida. A company called Moon Express has gotten a contract with NASA to utilize the same field that NASA's been using for testing the Morpheus spacecraft is the test vehicle that NASA's been doing, testing there for last year. They launched the spacecraft. It'll go up a quarter of a mile or so and fly around for a while, and then they'll bring it back to a landing area, and it will land totally autonomously. They just always land over there. It's got cameras, it's got lasers. It's got all these boulders put discriminately anywhere around the landing field. And this Morpheus spacecraft lands, finds a spot and lands. And the idea is to advance the technology of going to the moon or Mars. You'll be able to have these spacecraft bringing materials from place to place, or people from place to place, using this Morpheus type of spacecraft. Well, now Moon Express, a company that started around 2010, has now contracted with NASA to use it for their vehicle. They have a vehicle that will be eventually launched to the moon. The idea of Moon Express is to bring supplies down to the moon. Eventually, that's what they think you're going to need. You're going to have facilities. Maybe eventually people down there, little bases here and there. You're going to need supplies to be flown from place to place. So their goal is to eventually meet that market. But their first flight, they predict, will be in 2016. They hope to go as a secondary payload on a geosynchronous flight. They'll be up 23,000 miles, and then with their booster rocket, they'll be able to extend that elliptically until they eventually break out of the gravity well of the Earth, go into lunar orbit, and eventually land there. I mean, small spacecraft, it's only their first one is only about the size of a refrigerator. Drive it to WS-200.
Question for Paul when he has time.
Okay, John, is it about the last couple things we've been talking about?
AC2WGB. Yes, Paul. The first issue you were speaking I was just wondering, when they land on this platform, which I think you said is the size of a football field, how far off the Florida coast is it? And what are they going to do if, after launch, they have ground swells or high seas? How's that going to work?
Yeah, they have thrusters. They call them thrusters that are from oil rigs attached to this thing. And this thing will keep it stable within a foot or two where it's supposed to be. So that's going to control the latitude and longitude. Of course, it's not anchored to the sea floor. It's really a floating barge, but it's really big. I saw pictures of it on the computer. Helicopter view looking down. They have this black field and painted on it, and right in the middle is they have a target, and the center of the target is the logo of SpaceX, which is an X. Going to shoot for that. Once they land with the rocket vertically, and they have these things sticking out, there's not going to be anybody there to bolt down these things that are sticking out called legs. So it's going to be floating there for quite a while, and I haven't heard how they're going to go about this process of securing it once they do it. By the way, they give themselves a 50% chance of landing on this barge, but with about 12 flights going up this year, they think that they should eventually be able to do that. You know, each Falcon 9 rocket has 9 Merlin rockets on it. What they would like to do with SpaceX is to refurbish them and use them again over and over and over again. And that is the whole theory behind Elon Musk, the owner of SpaceX, is to drive the course of...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Don't throw the airplane away when you get there. So, another barge has this 170-foot width, but those are wings that open up. If you were to look at the barge, when the wings are folded down, I think it's about 90 feet wide, and then they open these things up and makes it wider. But the length is 300 feet. Now, as far as handling swells and all of that, I don't know how they have it set up. If there's any kind of hydraulics involved or anything, I can't get any details yet, John. When I get them, I'm going to bring it to the net. I'm sure they'll have to have something, especially if this first rocket that they try to land on a barge is successful. John, over to you, KC2WGB, WS2N.
Okay, Paul, yeah, that'll be very interesting because I'm looking at this thing, you know, rocking up and down. Maybe they'll have compensation with flotation and hydraulics. That might work. But, okay, and when you find out, you'll let us know. Very good. Sorry to interrupt. KC2WGB, back to net.
Yeah, I'm going to be very interested on how they do this. But right now, you know, the only way they can do it is have a rocket come down, land, and just leave it there for a long period of time. You know, completely unmanned. You're not allowed to have any personnel on board this thing when the rocket comes down. So they'll be nearby ships, and then eventually they'll go up to it, I guess. You know, in the future, they won't need to have this problem because they plan on having pinpoint accuracy time and time again. And once they do, the FAA will leave them alone, and maybe they'll be able to actually bring it all the way back to land. And that's the goal. And not only here, but in Vandenberg Air Force Base, they have a launch facility out there that they've launched a number of Falcon 9s off from, and they'll do quite a few this year as well. And they want to bring the spacecraft back to Vandenberg. They're building a new $100 million preliminary payment that they're making to build their another launch facility down in Texas, down near Brownsville, Texas. Right on the coast, right on the coast between Mexico and Texas. I mean, they have plenty of ambitious plans, so I hope it works out for them. They seem to be the most advanced out of every group. Orbital Science was doing pretty good there for a while with their unmanned cargo craft going into the International Space Station. But on the third try, Antares rocket blew up. So everybody wants to know what they're going to do to honor their almost $2 billion contract with NASA to send 8 flights up to the International Space Station. To do that, they don't want to use the NK-33 engines that they have been using for the Antares. They've had a couple of failures on the test bed down in Stennis in Mississippi. They don't want to have that happen again, but they went ahead and launched the Antares anyway, and sure enough, it blew up with the NK-33 on board. And the NK-33s were bought from Russia years ago. They're very old, decades old, and they were refurbished by Aerojet. Aerojet is a company that bought them up and turned around and sold them and installed them into the Antares rocket for orbital. To say they're not going to use them anymore. So they finally got a decision, I think, last week. And they wanted to make an arrangement with somebody to get new engines for their Antares rocket. And what they did is they made a deal with Russia to buy more rocket engines, except they're not the NK-33s, of course, but they're RD-181s. RD-181s are very similar to the RD-180s that are being used for United Launch Alliance that launches the Atlas rocket. So, I think it's so confusing that most people won't realize what they're doing. And I think if the public realize that they're just going to go out and buy more Russian engines, even so they're more advanced, they won't have the problems that the last ones had. I know I would like to see American built engines, but Orbital, I guess, is going to go with the Russians. They're going to ship in these RD-181s and use them for the Antares. They're good rockets. I mean, good engines. In fact, Russia was using a similar engine on their brand new Angara family of rockets that they're going to be using from now for the next probably 30 years. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. So we'll have to see what happens with the future launches. The next one or two launches won't be from Wallops Island for orbital because that facility is being rebuilt after the explosion of the Antares rocket with the Cygnus spacecraft on board. So that'll take about a year to do. So the next flight or two, they've contracted with United Launch Alliance to use the Atlas V rocket to launch the Cygnus spacecraft to the space station. So they'll do probably one or two flights like that. And then after that, they'll have their RD-181 engines from Russia. Probably by that time installed on the Antares. They'll have a new Wallops field built in Virginia, and they'll be able to continue to honor their almost $2 billion contract with NASA. And that's pretty much all I have for now. I know there's another flight coming, a manned flight coming up. I'll probably pay close attention to. It'll be a long duration flight for the United States as well as for Russia. I have an Expedition 44 going up with Mike Kelly. Not Mike, I'm sorry. Scott Kelly, his brother. Mark Kelly and Scott Kelly. This is Scott Kelly. They're both astronauts. They'll be going up for a year, long duration mission, along with a Russian counterpart. Although Russians have done this kind of thing before, the Americans haven't. It'll be the first long duration flight. And, what they're doing is getting ready for eventual flights, of course, to Mars. That's pretty much all I have tonight, Dick. Not much going on for the end of the year. But we got a lot coming up next year. Back to you, the K2RIWWS2N space portion of the TechNet.
I think I read somewhere, Paul, that Scott Kelly, I think you said on Expedition 44, is going to be making a expedition to the space, to the International Space Station for a solid year, and I remember reading that that's a new record, and I'm wondering about that. It seems to me that one of the earlier Soyuz missions had cosmonauts and astronauts that lasted a year. So give us a few words on that. Is this a record? Is it a full year? And has no one ever been on the International Space Station before for a year? But on the Russian space station, I called it Soyuz, it wasn't Soyuz, you'll correct me as to what its name. I seem to remember that somebody was on there for more than a year. It might have even been our female American astronaut. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, Shannon Lucid had the record for a while, 188 days, I think it was. But that was on board Mir. It would be a record, of course, for the International Space Station. Usually they go up for no more than 6 months, usually 5.5 months. So, and of course, a record for the United States as well. But on Mir, they had one guy went a year. One guy went over a year. I think he went like 400 days or something for the Russians. They have plenty of experience with this type of thing. But now, the United States, we want our own records. This will be the first of, probably quite a few. And because of this, you're creating another seat. Always two people going up, three people going up on every Soyuz flight. Usually three people come down, now you're going to have two people coming down. So because you're going to wind up with these missing seats here and there, the Russians are going to start up with their private citizens paying to go up to visit the International Space Station. This is not about, 8 or 9 times before. Last flight like that was 2009 by the guy that owns Cirque du Soleil. Let me drop it. And yeah, you were looking for the name of the space station before the Mir. That's Salyut 7. They had originally Salyut 1, and it's really like three different generation space stations for the Russians. The Salyut missions. They stayed up for months or even half a year. And then, of course, the Mir was second generation, and Russians consider the International Space Station part of theirs, of course, and that's the third generation. For us, it's like generation two. Drop it. We're in Skylab with three missions, three people on board each mission. So we had nine people go up to Skylab, and now, of course, we have the International Space Station. Well, we have to look forward in the future. Of course, there's no future American space station planned, but China has the Tiangong space station up there now, Tiangong 1, and eventually they're going to create a 2, which is going to be, of course, much bigger. And then you have a private station being built by Bigelow Space. So All in the not too distant future, I hope. Back to you, Dick. WS to me.
So from what you just told me, Scott Kelly is going to be there for a solid year. Almost everything I've read up to now leads me to believe that during your microgravity exposure, there's a continuous bone loss, loss of bone mass, a continuous depreciation of muscle mass, and I had the impression that even if an astronaut or cosmonaut does more than enough exercise and eats just the right diet, even so, the microgravity environment continues to give bone loss and muscle loss. And although you can attenuate the rate of loss, you can't stop the loss, is my impression. Therefore, I'm going to make a guess that when Scott Kelly comes back down, he's not going to walk off that spacecraft. He's going to be carried off with a stretcher, and after some recovery period on Earth, at some later time, he should, in theory, be able to walk. A couple of guesses on my part, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
A question, please.
Oh, yeah, they're not going to be walking. They don't walk now. If you ever see them come back from space and land in Kazakhstan on the ground, they have them all bundled up, laying down, and especially they carry them in to a transporter. I heard a question out there. Dick, do you want to take that?
Question person, please give us your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your question. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Hey, very nice to meet you, Dick. The call letters are Whiskey 2, November, Hotel Zulu. My name is Matt, Mike Alpha Tango Tango, from Northern New Jersey. And I've been listening quite a long time throughout the years to your TechNet. My question is, how long of a trip is it when they eventually decide to send a spacecraft to Mars? How long of a trip would that take to go one direction out to Mars? Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, Tom, nice question, Matt. Go right ahead, Paul, WS2N, our space expert. I'll bet you there's more than one answer to the Mars duration. You got a Paul.
Yeah, my guess is the first time out there, there's probably going to be a flyby orbit type of thing before they ever try a landing. But I assume, Matt, you're talking about when they eventually decide to land. You're looking at 6 to 8 months. That's usually what it takes to get to Mars. Depending on, where the two planets are, every 27 months they line up. So roughly every 2 years, you could have a launch to Mars. And that's what usually you see. You'll see the unmanned satellites that are going up. For instance, 2014, we had a launch just recently of the MAVEN spacecraft. It took about 6 to 7 months to get out there. And roughly around the same time, India launched a spacecraft called MOM, M-O-M, Mars Orbital Mission. And they successfully got out there right about the same time. Sometimes 8 months. Now, that's only to get you there. Now you have to orbit it, orbit Mars, and send a lander down, and probably spend the next 6 to 8 months at least on Mars. Drop it. Now, why so long? Well, there's no rush in getting back up, because by the time those planets are aligned again, it's almost a 2 year period for the best conjunction. So after spending some period down there, they come back up, hopefully dock up with their mothership, and deorbit Mars and come back to Earth for another 6 to 8 month trip. So there we say it's a 3 year deal. You know, just figure on 3 years, you've got to be able to comfortably do this. That means food, water, fuel, a living habitat. What you've seen going up a couple of weeks ago was the Orion spacecraft, which will carry 4 astronauts on board, eventually to the moon or to Mars, drop it. Those 4 astronauts, they say the spacecraft is built for 21 days. Well, like I just said, it's going to take you 6 to 8 months to get to Mars. So, Matt, if you wonder what they're going to do, they're in the process of designing and building a habitat module. Habitat module is something probably the size of the Discovery module that's part of the United States segment of the International Space Station. They'll put something up there that big, and they'll be able to have living quarters in a habitat module. The Orion will be docked to it. Off they go to Mars, and with the landing craft attached, send the landing craft down, spend half a year on Mars or more, and come back up, attach back to the habitat module, and then blast away back to Earth. It's a rough idea of what they plan, Matt. So back to you, Dick, WS2.
From what I'm hearing, Paul, is that very rough numbers, a manned landing on Mars, sounds like it's a healthy 3 year, 3.5 year mission. And from my point of view, that represents 2 very serious problems. When you're in the International Space Station, you're below the level of the Van Allen Belt, and you're below the majority of the Earth's magnetic field, and that Earth's magnetic field is a beautiful shield for a high percentage of the solar wind, cosmic rays, all kinds of nasty things that want to bombard a human being in space. So we're inside of a bunch of shields when we're in orbit around the Earth in the International Space Station. Let me drop. During this Mars mission, of roughly a year and a half to Mars, roughly a year or so on Mars, another year and a half to come home. During all of that time, you have none of the protection of the Earth's atmosphere, the Earth's magnetic field, the Van Allen Belt. All of these are protection mechanisms, and you're out beyond them. So every time a coronal mass expulsion from the sun occurs, if those particles happen to be aimed at your spacecraft, on the way to or from Mars, or on the surface of Mars. Mars gives you almost no protection. It has essentially no atmosphere. It has essentially no magnetic field. So whether you're in your spacecraft or you're on the surface of Mars, you're unprotected as far as many of these high velocity, high energy particles that want to bombard you and do damage. Let me drop. So the total radiation exposure human beings are going to get in a Mars mission, my understanding is that's very significant. The astronauts that went to the moon were only there for a couple of days, and they experienced a significant amount of radiation exposure. A couple of years to a Mars mission is a hell of a lot more. But there's an even slightly more serious problem than that. Let me drop. And that is, in order to maintain the astronauts in the International Space Station, a few times per year, a cargo ship goes up there with 5,000 pounds of consumables to maintain a human being for 1 year. It takes a whole lot of oxygen, water, and food on the way in, and a whole lot of carbon dioxide, fluid, and solid material coming back out. The amount of mass and volume, if I take the oxygen you're going to breathe and I put it in compressed bottles, and I take the food and compress it as much as I can, put it in dry packages or whatever, I do all the right things to minimize the mass and minimize the volume of the consumables required to maintain life for a human being. very rough rule of thumb is the water, food, and air that you consume in 1 year has approximately the volume of your house and approximately the mass of your house. So one house full of mass and one house full of volume, rough numbers, maintains one human being for 1 year. Let me drop. And here with a Mars mission, we're probably talking about three human beings for 3 years. That's nine houses worth. So the mass of your house times nine and the volume of your house times nine is just the raw material that maintains your life for 3 years of the three astronauts. To ship that much mass and volume along with the astronauts to Mars, as I see it, represents a very serious challenge. And we can sit here and say, well, we'll just reprocess. Let me drop. We'll reprocess the carbon dioxide that comes out of human beings. We'll remove the carbon dioxide, turn it back into oxygen. We'll reprocess the water that comes out of a human being. We'll reprocess the solid material that comes out of a human being. These words roll off the tongue real easily. To really do that for three human beings for three solid years without a hiccup in any of that reprocessing machinery, to have the right raw energy going in and all the right processes to reprocess all of that material, to sustain, to continuously supply the consumable materials to maintain a human being, I see that as a very serious problem. That's problem number two. Problem number three, going to Mars is more than 100 and maybe 1,000 times more difficult than going to the moon for a whole bunch of reasons. The Apollo mission to the moon was a $31 billion project in 1970 dollars. If going to Mars is 100 to 1,000 times more difficult, probably at least 100 times more expensive, no one nation can do that. That's going to take the pooling of the resources of almost every advanced nation on planet Earth. If you get them to all agree to invest that much money and resources in that big a project, a hell of a lot of those nations that are candidates for that contribution are going to say, what do I get in return? What do I get for my money? Let me drop. To be very pessimistic, then they'll say, okay, the first astronaut, the first cosmonaut, the first Chinese, I forget what word they use, to stand on Mars is going to be from my nation. And this represents progress. But why do you want to send a human being there in the first place? You send the remotely piloted spacecraft called Curiosity there, and for years on end, under a nuclear power supply, it makes whatever measurements you want and sends the data back home on a radio beam. And maybe someday you want to send a mission there that scoops up some of the soil and brings it back home. But to send a human being there just to say it's progress and we're doing it, you're sending a human being into an area that has almost no air, extremely cold weather, extremely high winds, extremely arid environment. Why in the world do you want to send a human being there? You can see my doubts. Maybe being overly pessimistic. But it is my belief that essentially nobody within the sound of my voice right now, within their lifetime, is going to see a human being standing on Mars, unless we make some huge breakthrough in rocket power and life-sustaining techniques. And we're talking about two or three orders of magnitude of improvement in speed and volume and mass and time and expense. Unless we make 100-to-1 or 1,000-to-1 improvements in the requirements for this, I don't see it happening. Now, maybe I'm overly pessimistic, but do you see where I'm going on this one, Matt? N2 November Hotel Zulu, K2RIW in the TechNet. Comment.
Okay, very good. Very good. Well received. Very, very amazing answer, which brings up very other amazing questions, ones that I am most likely a lot of others have not thought about. But Dick, you have cer-